talking about a new material, and the question is, why should one be interested? Why should you be interested? Why should you show up at 10 o'clock to hear about this? And that's mainly what I'm going to talk about, is why it may be interesting. This is a new cuprate. It's a cuprate, which, and I'm going to spend some time looking at the data. Ferromagnetic at 132 Kelvin, superconducting around 40 degrees, depending on preparation of the sample, annealing and whatever. And so the question, you're not going to get many answers today, but I'm going to dance around the question, how big a deal is this? Is a superconducting ferromagnet really something new or not? Collaborators on the calculations I will describe toward the end a little bit. Reuben Waite, who is right over here, and Sasha Schick. Okay. It's quite different. Yeah. Okay. So this is a little bit of sort of an introduction to the questions and what I'm going to be talking about. Not exactly. Not exactly. His was a O10. His was a little different. He reported ruthenyl cuprates that were not ferromagnetic, anti-ferromagnetic, and superconducting. Okay. So basic questions about superconductivity in a ferromagnet. Now, mostly I'm going to be talking about assuming singlet superconductivity, triplet superconductivity in a ferromagnet. A different question. It's maybe not so difficult a question, but I'm going to talk about singlet. And I'm not going to be considering the case where the magnetic transition temperature and the superconducting critical temperature are comparable. That's got enormous study in the last 25 years since the rhodium borides in the late 70s and the Chevrel phases, and now it's the borocarbides in the 90s have this kind of behavior where the superconducting critical temperature and the magnetic ordering temperature, often anti-ferromagnetic but sometimes ferromagnetic, occur at about the same temperature, 5 degrees or 10 degrees or something like that. And there's competition between the two, and they try to accommodate each other. But that's not the question here. This is a good magnet, well into the ferromagnetic phase, and then it becomes superconducting. Okay, magnetism inhibits superconductivity through coupling to spins with a Zeeman-like splitting like this. And if it's internal magnetization, then the coupling is either dipolar, just through the Eagle electro dynamic dipolar interaction, or through electronic exchange splitting. Of course, if it's just applied magnetic field, then it's just this term right here. But both of these give rise to a term that looks like that, a Zeeman splitting. The other type of coupling is to the orbital motion. It's the coupling to the vector potential, gives you orbital currents, vortices, mixed states, and so forth. Now, if this is superconducting and ferromagnetic, and it's going to be a quasi-two-dimensional system we're talking about here, so this applies to layered systems, the 3D superconducting order requires coupling through the ferromagnetic layers, and the 3D ferromagnetic order requires coupling through the superconducting layers. So there are questions just how this coupling is large enough to give three-dimensional order, but still small enough to allow the superconductor to be superconducting, mainly. I'll get to that in extremely short time here. Superconducting layers. Oh, presumably it's cuprate. Presumably it's like standard cuprate. Yeah, possibly magnetic fluctuations. That hasn't been studied. Right. We'll get to that. 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 Okay, Ginsburg in 1957 considered this question. How can it happen? He said it can't. Okay, so I'll go through that. Okay, he knew it was a little more complicated than that, but basically, this can't happen. Okay, this was 1957, before he had ever seen BCS theory. Didn't need BCS theory for what he did, considering this is just the coupling to the electromagnetic field, vector potential. Consider the simplest geometry, a wire, a post, whatever, a magnetic, think of it as iron, a magnetic wire. Magnetization along the axis. Forget about this for 1 minute. Okay, he just used London equation electrodynamics. What we're assuming here is that the magnetization is due to high energy exchange, electronic exchange processes. It's frozen in. Superconductivity is not going to change that. So with the London equation, which is what he had to work with then, which is still perfectly good for many purposes, the supercurrent's proportional to the vector potential. You take the curl of both sides, you get this equation. Field equation relating H, and he argued H, not B, to the supercurrent. And B equals H plus 4 pi M, electro E and M. And, okay, you just put those in, this kind of geometry, and you get related equations for either the magnetic flux or the supercurrent, but if we just concentrate on the supercurrent. This is del square J sub S minus constant times J sub S is proportional to del cross M. And in the bulk, in the inside of this, if it's a large wire, it's fine. M's a constant throughout here. That's zero over here. And you can get a J sub S equals zero solution, no problem. But at the edge, there's a discontinuity. The magnetization goes to zero outside. There's a discontinuity. There's a source term here. And that drives currents. And if you look at the solution, you get an induced supercurrent profile here. In fact, just like you do in regular Meissner effect, except that this is an inverse Meissner effect. What this does is to generate a magnetic field, H, which is opposite to 4 pi m and makes B zero inside the wire. It's an inverse Meissner effect. It tries to shield the outside world from the magnetization here. The magnitude of that current has to be proportional to the area. And therefore, for a large wire, it will just cost too much energy, and it will quench, it will self-quench. And in fact, this will only be possible, Ginsburg said, if this radius or diameter is of the order of the penetration depth. So only for extremely thin wires. That's what the induced current tries to accomplish. It can only accomplish it without costing too much energy if it's a very, very thin wire. Right. Now you notice there's nothing here about triplet superconductivity or singlet superconductivity. This is just considering the orbital currents. And that's not differentiated at the levels singlet or cup.
Because in free field physics, you have to stick an H and an O B in the equation.
He argues that it's very important, and that to get the correct limits, I can't reproduce the arguments right now, but to get, he considered that, yeah. So actually, I prepared these views just in the last couple of days, because the ones I have are back in Davis, and so some of them are going to be a little wordier than usual, because they'll be put on the web pages here, and I will put these references.
Is it obvious that if you had a triplet superconductor, that it could spread out?
Yeah, It's certainly the case that triplet pairing has not been looked at very much in this regard, as far as I know. I don't see how this argument would be affected so strongly. It's perhaps a question to look into.
So what do you want to say, that isn't it possible that maybe if you use a triple pairing would somehow compensate for the top part?
That's the point, yeah. That's exactly the point.
Well, let's
very much. But M is kind of local speed from each side.
So right, that's let's maybe come back to that at the end. In the last week, I've become aware of a review article, 1985, by Bulieski and three other authors in Advances in Physics, which is 85 pages long. It's titled Coexistence of Superconductivity and Magnetism. And to the question we're addressing today, it gives one paragraph. It describes Ginsburg's paper. And the rest is about this other kinds of coexisting superconductivity, competing anti-ferromagnetism. So this really, the question of superconductivity arising in a real ferromagnet is a new one. So let's investigate whether this material is what it seems.
But maybe just from a general point of view, as far as I understand, the standard argument why people say that it's impossible. That one of them is the particle effect, but another is maybe more important than that. Then we have to compare, say, condensation energy or superconductivity with energy gain, the energy gain due to thermodynamics. And then we have to compare.
We're going to find. We're going to find, I think, there's a more serious question is really the exchange splitting, electronic exchange splitting in the ferromagnet. Because if you think of something like iron, and it has one Fermi surface, I don't know what it's like,
yeah,
but
this will give rise to the Bayer-Lager
achievement. No. It has a spin-up Fermi surface. Okay, it's symmetric, but the simplest case would be one like this, and another one, which is quite different in volume and cubic symmetry. So, and if you try to pair a K up with a minus K down, your pair has a very large net momentum. And what you're saying about this Fool de Ferrel type of superconductivity we'll get to. But in a normal strong ferromagnet, the Fermi surfaces are extremely different in general. So the question of how you can try to arrange singlet pairing is one where you practically can't in those kinds. And that's one of the questions I'll address here.
On the other hand, all these arguments for bulk material. I have layered material in which my magnetization is such that magnetic field is parallel to the layer, so it's kind of sitting between the layers. Maybe all these arguments wouldn't be valid anymore.
Okay. We'll get to that. Right. That's true. Okay, this is the structure of the material. It you can think of it as just being YBCO. It has two copper oxygen layers, but instead of the copper oxygen chain, you take it out and put in a ruthenium O2 layer. So it's copper oxygen layer. In between that and the next layer down here, which is up here, is a gadolinium ion. Up here is a strontium oxide layer and then a ruthenium O2 layer. And in an idealized structure, it just looks like this. This is what I said, copper oxygen layers here with gadolinium in between and a ruthenium. Now, there's a complication once one gets to worrying about details in that the unit cell really, there's a rotation of the ruthenium oxide octahedra because they don't fit well with the copper oxygen. And there's a root 2 by root 2 doubling of the unit cell, but it's a standard kind of perovskite instability. And we don't need to worry about that for the purposes of this talk. The experimentalist can make a nice picture of the structure. This is the copper oxygen layers, apical oxygen, ruthenium oxygen, octahedra. Okay, so that's the kind of structure we're talking about. And the picture that's going to arise arose from the experiments, also from our calculations. The ruthenium oxide layer wants to be magnetic, wants to be ferromagnetic, and the superconductivity looks for all the world like its ordinary cuprate conductivity on the copper layers.
So the identity of the rare earth metals, can you make it with a lot of rare earths?
It matters. You can make it fairly well with one or two other. Europium, I think, and you put in cerium and things start to change, but they haven't been able to make it with anything else, I think.
The ferromagnetism is due to ruthenium and not due to gadolinium.
That's right. The gadolinium, I'll tell you, the gadolinium is magnetic, of course. It orders antiferromagnetically at 2.5 Kelvin. In YBCO, same thing happens if you put in gadolinium and make it gadolinium BCO. It orders antiferromagnetically at 2.5 Kelvin. It doesn't bother the superconductivity at all. That's
same here, yeah.
That's same here. They say it's about one Bohr magneton per ruthenium is the value of the moment. So here I'm going to go through most of the relevant data. This is just a resistivity curve showing the onset of superconductivity for two different samples. And here is a blow up showing the same resistivity curves. The second one's been annealed, so that the transition is higher and maybe a little sharper. And the AC susceptibility comes up just about where the resistivity finally vanishes, which is a common behavior. This is the zero field-cooled volume susceptibility. Here's the susceptibility, the Curie temperature right here, where it becomes ferromagnetic, then down here like this, and then these two samples, one like this, one like this, comes down to essentially minus 100%. This is okay. This is I can't answer this question for certain, but it's been measured in fields down to 2 Gauss or whatever, and zero field cooled. I guess this is actually compensating for the Earth's magnetic field when they do this. I'll show you another bit of data a little later. Next view graph, maybe.
I mean, the small below.
Okay.
Does it mean that there are mainly the males or whatever, so what is it? What is actually the state of the blue? I'm not the state of the blue. Magnetic state.
I don't have a...
Not magnetic properties. How do they look like?
The magnetic properties up here at this temperature look like a ferromagnet, which has a Curie temperature of 130, 132 Kelvin. This is showing magnetization in a tenth of a Tesla. This looks like this. This is one Tesla. And it's sort of reaching a saturation value here. And this is what you get here if you take these curves and subtract out what they call the gadolinium contribution. So you're getting some kind of saturation, maybe around one Bohr magneton. This is part of at least where they get their value of one Bohr magneton per ruthenium for the saturation magnetization. It's right here. This is not bulk magnetization plotted here, I guess. This is, but it looks like this. This is the magnetic. These are local magnetic fields. These are local magnetic fields. So probably, if you want much more detail than what these have, you have to look at the papers. I don't know how they can discriminate between those with just magnetization data. They can tell whether it's soft or hard magnetism, and I can't remember what the coercive field is. But Ruben, do you remember? No.
I mean, but this was more, this, coming back to this question, this picture, after picture looks like this is just no ferromagnetism over there below.
But here. Here is the. This is local field. The μSR experiments have been done. So the muon is shot into the sample, positive muon, with polarization, and it depolarizes according to the magnetic field it sees at its local site.
So it's quite possible to have local field.
And the muon, these muons see only one field. All muons see the same field. And this is the temperature dependence of that field. One of these curves is. The other one is the temperature dependence of the field at the gadolinium site from ESR. So so this is measuring the local field.
Okay,
yeah.
So this is non-zero. Mm-hmm. But average field according to Ginsburg,
that's right. So that's this zero field cooled volume susceptibility. Would indicate yes, that the volume of the material is shielded, right? Okay. They don't know. Well, it's they only have polycrystalline samples so far, ceramic polycrystalline samples so far. So the field. If you look at this, right, I don't know. If you look at this, you can see a little bit of structure there. It's just visible. But most of this magnitude is due to the polycrystalline nature of it. And presumably the temperature dependence is roughly right. But it may be a bit too early to try to analyze the resistivity. Yeah, and here it starts up, but if you kneel it, get a little higher TC and sharper transition, then it does something like that. So it's behaving.
Are you going to talk about the valence state of the ruthenium here and the.
We can.
One electron that you got, because this is notionally, this is ruthenium 5. If it was copper 2, it would be ruthenium 5, which is.
What we calculate, of course, this is a metal, so the valence counting is a little dicey. What we get is about 4.5 d electrons on the ruthenium in the calculation. And the oxygens are not fully 2 minus and all those questions. Yeah.
So is there a double exchange mechanism with the ruthenium that responds?
It looks to us very much like itinerant ferromagnetism. It's strong hybridization between the ruthenium and the oxygen, and okay, you get this related sort of thing in the manganites.
Also,
those questions.
Also, the three dimensional ferromagnet, strong ruthenium oxide. That also is a metal itinerant ferromagnet.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay, I just want to, this is all the same, thermal power. Here is a question about bulk superconductivity. This is specific heat divided by temperature, so that's the gamma. up around the critical temperature, and it's the gamma minus a reference sample, which has 3% zinc doped. And what that doping does is reduce TC by about 10 degrees per percent of zinc. So TC is reduced down here somewhere. And so that's the reference, that's taken off. And when you do that subtraction, you're left with a peak at TC like this. This is as grown, this is annealed, so it's a little sharper. But it's exactly the same kind, size, when comparable things are done in the BISCO material. So this looks like bulk specific heat anomaly. No, doesn't do a thing to ferromagnetism. Still 102, you know. They from in their early I think they've done that, but I think they've done that, and I think certainly the early papers said that the transport they would interpret in terms of an underdoped material. I don't remember if their chemical analysis was consistent with that or not. Now this is the first preprint I've seen by somebody outside. I didn't tell you. Jeff Tallon is the one who's made these samples, collaborating with several different people to get all these measurements made. He's in New Zealand. He's done lots and lots of very good work on cuprates over the last 10 years. Now this is Paul Chu's group. This has just been on the web, I think, for a week or so. I believe that's where I got this. Absence of bulk Meissner state is what the title of this paper is. So here's a zero field cooled curve of the material they made, which is just like that Tallon samples show. And this is field cooled with 2-ersted. And so they are clearly questioning, well, not clearly, I mean, sort of implying, be careful, they're not saying it, that this is not a bulk superconductor. But one possibility is it's not a bulk superconductor. Another possibility is that this is evidence for spontaneous vortex phase, which I will get into. Well, maybe the next view graph. What's that mean? Let me just finish up. I think I've said all this already. Mu SR, only one relaxation time. By the way, in cuprates, the mu SR people know where the muon goes. They assume it goes the same place it attaches to the apical oxygen. And because they know where it goes, well, they know that the field is homogeneous. They know that there's no change in the local field at the muon below the superconducting transition. So the magnetization is unaffected by superconductivity. And the value of the field they calculate, if they assume one Bohr magneton on each ruthenium and put it parallel to the layers, perpendicular to the z-axis, parallel to the layers, and calculate the field at the muon, then they good agreement with what they measure. And if they put it perpendicular, then the value they would get is different by 50% or something, enough so that suggests to them that the field is in the layer. Yes?
How do they know that the field is homogeneous?
Oh, but it goes many places in the sample. That's all they mean. It's homogeneous from place to place in the sample. There's not different regions of the material with different magnetic properties. I mentioned the zinc doping. Yeah.
This exercise of motion, I mean, so its chemical silent is the CU level, but it's supported by the filming of the supportivity is fully dimensional. Those feeling currents in the plane parallel to the CS. So if I have to get back on a session like this,
Let's get into those questions. There are other ways out, But this is my picture. So here is a microscopic picture. I'm picturing the ruthenium oxide layer having a magnetization, which you can think of as being just homogeneous magnetization in the layer, and you know, a couple of angstroms thick, or whatever you want to call that layer. And the copper oxygen bilayer is here and here. And if the magnetization points in the plane, then you just look at matching conditions and consider this a sort of macroscopic situation, which you really shouldn't, then the magnetic flux confined in here satisfies the boundary conditions. Whatever the magnetic flux does, you can choose the vector potential to be, well, as long as it's in this direction, you can choose the vector potential to be in this direction. And then if you ignore interplanar hopping, then this flux does not affect the transport within the copper oxygen plane. Okay? So the muons stop here.
There are no different positions, let's say, this somewhere, the orange and the green.
No, they think the muon stops here, here, you know, every apical oxygen here, all equivalent sites.
When?
They think that from studying other cuprates for 6 or 8 years. And calculations and whatever. Okay.
Why can the net effect be similar to the mixed state?
Well, let's delay that question if we can till. Okay, the other possibility is that the magnetization points perpendicular, and if you're above the superconducting transition temperature, then it just runs through here like this. But if you go below, the superconducting state here has to accommodate it in vortices. My vortices are much more explicit than Matthew's were yesterday, but okay, you get something like this. This is what's been called the spontaneous vortex phase.
In the universe, I mean, I would have the intuition that these magnetic fields would be really very large. Wouldn't it be far as, let's say, C2 or normal progressive vortex?
The magnetic fields, the internal magnetic field.
Yeah, internal magnetic
field. Okay, good question. So the next view graph. Let's start looking at some numbers. It's not the exchange fields, it's the... Okay. Right. So this... Here's your answer to the question. The average field. Volume average. So this is the volume average magnetization. So it's one Bohr magneton per ruthenium in this unit cell. It's 700 Gauss. That's just the volume average. That's the macroscopic magnetization you would have. That is, for reference, 1/30th the value of the iron. As iron has 2.2 Bohr magnetons per iron, and there's enough space in this cell for 15 irons, whatever. Okay. So that's the size of the field. okay, the resulting dipolar Zeeman splitting, mu B times that, 5 microelectron volts. That's much smaller than anything else we're going to consider. So let's don't worry about the dipolar field effect on anything except conceivably magnetic coupling of layers, but nothing else. superconducting transition at 40 Kelvin, a gap, various experiments might put it at 5 KTC, something like that, whatever you'd call the gap, is the order of 15 millielectron volts. So I'm going to begin to start mentioning our calculations. First thing, we calculate an exchange splitting on the ruthenium. We do local spin density calculations of this material. The ruthenium oxide layer comes out ferromagnetic. The exchange splitting there is of the order of 1 electron volt. But the induced exchange coupling on the copper oxygen layers is of the order, this is not equal, of the order of 25 millielectron volts. And this is the same order of magnitude as the gap. Okay? If this is much larger than the gap, then it should destroy superconductivity. if it's
due to spin failure.
This is causing spin de-pairing. This is causing spin de-pairing.
It's much more dangerous than Lubotiana. What would be
the internal magnetic field is 700 Gauss. This is the average. This is the average internal magnetic field. HC2 is presumably many tens of Tesla. A relevant question is HC1. And the last few days, I've been trying to identify HC1 values for cuprates. And even papers that study have been studying these questions mostly are concentrating on near TC, and they don't bother to say what people think the T equals zero HC1 value is. But I think it's a few tens of Gauss, maybe a few hundreds. Yes. Probably along the C-axis, I think, is what.
Sorry, I don't understand.
But let's.
Why did you get the internal field? Because internal field, I think, is the order of TC, usually. And TC is 150 Kelvin, then internal field will be 150 Gauss.
Which internal field?
150 Kelvin.
Which internal field? You're talking about
in
this?
Virginium itself.
In
Virginium itself. Virginium itself. Internal field, which makes it ferromagnetic.
That's what I'm going to talk about. But that's not. But this is the same order of magnitude as an iron, and the Curie temperature. Well, it's factor of three smaller. But the magnetism doesn't look so much different than magnetism and other.
The main problem is that there is no exchange coupling between the ruthenium and copper.
Okay, so. We're going to get to those questions. Phil? Well, okay. Yes. Do you know what the T equals zero value is for H perpendicular?
YBCO, I think, it's just under 100 Gauss.
Okay, I think that's the kind of numbers that we're talking about. So the point is, having superconductor in a magnetic field is not a big deal. The Earth has a magnetic field. The HC1 is where trouble starts to happen. So we need to know if HC1 were a factor of, were bigger than the 700 Gauss that I was talking about, then the 700 Gauss wouldn't be much of a hindrance to the superconductivity. So this is just a result of local spin density calculations applied to this material. This is majority spin, minority spin. This is just illustrating that you have two copper oxygen bands, just as you always have in all these cuprates. And those look the same, spin up and spin down. The ruthenium bands, outlined in yellow here, you can see are quite different here. The exchange splitting is more than one electron volt between here and here. So there's strong exchange splitting on the ruthenium and a weak exchange splitting on the copper oxygen layers.
We can look at it as basically a sort of rigid shift of
a rigid shift of these. You shouldn't be able to see any shift. Well, maybe if you look right there, you can actually see the value. Yeah, it's around. Well, that's probably a little bit more for this band right here. On this piece of Fermi surface from right here, that's what's around 20, 25 millivolts. So let me just get at this question Daniel is raising. This is density of states decomposed into the ruthenium D, and it's the T2Gs that are involved in the magnetization. In tetragonal symmetry, the DXY is distinct from XZ and YZ, but in fact, chemically, they're not much different here. The magnetization involves more or less all of the T2G orbitals. The ruthenium oxygen is strongly polarized. You can see states here, majority states occupied. A lot of this is just hybridization. Most of the oxygen P states are down there. And now, the apical oxygen, the one that's between the ruthenium and the copper, is different. The PX and PY, perpendicular to the layers, are polarized. So here, again, most of their weight's down here, but they're hybridized with both the ruthenium and, to a smaller extent, the copper. And the PXY are polarized, but the PZ is not polarized. You can see the PZ is this dashed line here and dashed line here. It's not any different between spin up and spin down. And that's because the ruthenium T2G states do not couple to this. Okay? And that's the beginning of the reason why the exchange coupling between the ruthenium layer and the copper oxygen layer is small. Now let me show you one Fermi surface which turns out to be particularly interesting here. This is the bilayer symmetric barrel Fermi surface. This is two Fermi surfaces here. This is both the majority and the minority. The outer one is the majority. The inner one is the minority. This has a little wiggle here because it's hybridizing with another piece that's not shown here. Actually, the width here is showing you how much Z dispersion we calculate. So these are really very strongly two-dimensional, quasi-two-dimensional, but just slight dispersion. And these have flat edges, relatively flat, with a separation in Q of the order of 10 to the minus 2 of the distance between gamma and X. Okay, so I'm going to talk about this Fulda-Farrell-Larkin-Ovchinnikov state briefly. Let me just show you some other Fermi surfaces. This is due to exchange coupling, and it doesn't make any difference. Okay. This is the copper oxygen layer bilayer antisymmetric Fermi surface. You can see it's not doesn't have nearly so flat edges. In fact, this majority one has more ruthenium character probably. It has more dispersion. Okay, these I just want to illustrate why we're particularly interested in this other one is because it is. Has flat surfaces and the splitting is quite small. If you want, you can look at, I've already shown you these outside, but you can look at ruthenium Fermi surfaces. They're all around, but they're very extremely different for spin up and spin down. Now, let me just answer Daniel's question about induced exchange splitting. This is awfully wordy. Okay, both ruthenium oxide and the copper oxide layers are metallic in our calculations. The direct coupling route is through the apical oxygen. However, the magnetization is in the T2G orbitals of the ruthenium, and those are orthogonal to the apical PZ orbitals, the one that points at the copper. So there's no coupling there. And this PZ orbital is also orthogonal to the copper dx squared minus y squared orbital, which is the most important one in the copper oxygen plane. The ruthenium T2G states have overlap with apical PX and PY, but they don't. They're orthogonal to this. So the direct route gives zero coupling, if the structure is ideal at least. So the coupling has to, apparently, we haven't analyzed this in detail, but what coupling there is has to be from ruthenium to apical oxygen to an oxygen in the copper layer to the copper, or ruthenium oxygen and ruthenium layer to the apical oxygen to the copper. Something, I think, probably this first one. Anyway, that's the basic reason why the exchange coupling, the induced splitting in the copper oxygen layer, is so small. Now, yeah.
Especially at higher temperatures, where the stiffness of cuprite is pretty high, right? I guess that would ruthenium oxide is a really normal atomic group number.
Well, the value of this resistivity, I think, has got nothing to do with intrinsic. It's very high. It's 5 milli ohm centimeters. And that's just the granular. That's just the granular.
Yeah.
It. If you remember the first 6 months, I remember well the first 6 months of high TC, where the resistivity curve looked like that, and 2 months later it looked like this, and 2 months later it looked like that. And I had a plot. So it stayed here, but the magnitude and the slope were coming down. Right. Yeah. Okay. That's. No, I don't know of any experiment. Again, this resistivity is way too high because of the granular nature. So if you use that calculated mean free path, you would get a tenth of an angstrom or something, which would be ridiculous. Okay, so let me just spin this one view graph on what's called the FFLO, superconducting phase, or sometimes the LOFF. This is due to Fuld and Ferrell, 1964, very independently, Larkin and Ovchinnikov, 64. They considered the BCS system with concentrated magnetic impurities. But, okay, in fact, they considered a system just exactly like we're talking about here, the exchange splitting, and they're dealing with the exchange coupling of the conduction electrons to these magnetic impurities. And not considering the scattering from the magnetic impurities, of course, in this ruthenium material, it's periodic, so there wouldn't be that kind of scattering. But what they consider is just a BCS Hamiltonian plus an additional term in the Hamiltonian, which splits upspin and downspin energies on the electrons. No orbital motion. So, Fuld and Ferrell in particular is what I'm following here a little bit, but zero field Fermi surface is just sphere. And you apply a field that polarizes the electrons, so the majority Fermi surface gets larger, minority gets smaller. This is greatly, greatly exaggerated here, but that's what happens. And now, if you want to consider singlet superconductivity, which is what they were considering, what you have to do is try to pair spin up electron on the Fermi surface with a spin down electron on that Fermi surface. Those have two different values of K. When you add them together, it leaves this Q, which is the separation of the Fermi surfaces. As a result of this, this immediately gives a tendency towards de-pairing. And if you just set this to, say, 3 times the BCS gap, you won't get any solution. However, if you set it roughly equal to it, or maybe even a little larger, what each of these people found out was that you begin to get different kinds of solutions, broken symmetry solutions, in which this Fermi surface, now I've reduced the Fermi surface down to one circle here. You still have pairing over some portion of the Fermi surface, and you have unpaired electrons here, de-paired, referred to. This is broken symmetry on the Fermi surface. It gives, in particular, a supercurrent, net supercurrent this way, because the ground state has to have zero current. It's going to be a net normal current this way. You get, because you have a supercurrent that's not zero, you're going to have phase variation in your order parameter. And a simplest sort would be of this form, where this Q is related to these two. So it's complex and varies in real space like this. And instead of getting a simple BCS phase diagram like this, you get something that might, certain models, look like this. This is TC and HC, but above the first critical field, you go into a region where this effective field is high, and you get other kinds of these FFLO type solutions to the equations. And just as an example,
that H is some an orbital bifield.
No.
Bifield, that's
no. This is just. Oh, this is. This is. Yeah. Yeah. So, in relation to this picture, this they didn't put a kind of picture like this in their paper, but this would correspond to this internal exchange field. However, I mean, there's actually been quite a bit of work, both theoretically and experimentally, to try to detect this. This is just a recent paper on the web, which is one of the sort of nicest I've seen. What these people are doing are applying magnetic fields to this two-dimensional organic superconductor, TC equal 10.5 Kelvin, applying magnetic field in the plane. And the magnetic field, and this is the value of the magnetic field, and this is one phase line they detect. Here's another one they detect, and this is a particular model of a calculation in 1994. Can't quite remember. Shimihara, I think, is the person. But they take this as evidence of FFLO state here. And here they're putting the field in the layer, and they have to be very precise about keeping this field in the layer, because if they let it go out by even a few tenths of a degree, then the orbital effects kill the superconductivity. Because the critical field is really down here, the HC. This is really due to Zeeman splitting. That's right. And what we have, what we presumably have in this ruthenium cuprate, is a large exchange split, large on the scale of exchange splittings, large on the scale of magnetic fields, this exchange splitting in the copper oxygen layer, which is 20, 25 millielectron volts, which is 300 tesla, whatever that turns into. Some of it's resistive. I cut the legend off here. There's resistance measurements. And I can't remember. Okay, so let's go back. They are, they can certainly see the orbital effect once they move the field out of the planes just slightly. So they think the vector potential is perpendicular and therefore is not in effect when it's really in the plane. That I can't tell you. It's probably information on it with certain models. Possibly when you're down at 10 Kelvin or 5 Kelvin. It's awfully tough when you're up at 40 or 50 Kelvin because of the background heat. But so, okay, let me finish some of the numbers here. So I've already mentioned this 20 to 25. One thing we found is that in our calculations, not only are results pretty sensitive to positions of oxygens, we know this because experimentalists initially gave us wrong positions of apical oxygen and so forth, so we did early calculations with somewhat wrong structure, but it also makes a difference in the moment we calculate whether we use standard local spin density or the generalized gradient approximation. And so we can't specify any best theoretical value for what this exchange splitting on this Fermi surface is right now, but it's the same order of magnitude as the gap you would expect. The calculated layer splitting of this Fermi surface, the calculated splitting Q that I was talking about is of the order of 10 to the minus 2 pi over A, which gives a wavelength of 400 angstroms. And that is substantially larger than the in-plane coherence length. And actually, calculations that Reiner's been doing the last two or three years, Reiner's collaborators, suggest, well, first of all, there are several suggestions that flat pieces of Fermi surface will enhance the tendency toward an FFLO state. The other thing is that what Reiner finds is if you plot the order parameter in real space, then what is favored is something like a domain wall. If the wavelength here is much greater than the coherence length, then what you tend to have is constant here, and then over the range of something like a coherence length, it changes sign. No reason why it should be sinusoidal at all. Right. Okay. So the fact that this exchange splitting and the BCS, or the superconducting gap, are comparable suggests the possibility of an FFLO phase here. Possible spontaneous vortex lattice, just in case you're wondering. This 700 Gauss average internal field corresponds to one flux quantum per radius of 0.7 microns. That's scale. Now, another possibility, which is, I'm not really going to talk about how superconducting coupling goes through the ferromagnetic layer or ferromagnetic coupling goes through the superconducting layer because we don't have any particular results on that. I think it's quite possible because of the thinness of the layers and the characteristics of the material, the fact that it's atomic scale and atomic scale.
But if coupling goes via ferromagnetic layer, then not the same as simply going via normal metallic layer.
That's right.
It may give you a lot of things that were considered basic. It may give you this ferromagnetic
phase. Right. It may give you this pi phase. That if you have superconducting layers separated by a ferromagnet, then one way is that it can help accommodate the system is if the phase of the order parameter changes sign from layer to layer. That's called the pi phase. And there's been a fair amount of experimental work trying to make things like gadolinium, niobium layers and whatever, and it's really difficult to get down to the regime you need to be and retain superconductivity in the superconducting material. Here we have a natural atomic scale system which currently has a superconducting layer and a ferromagnetic layer, so this is a real possibility. Paper by Sotomello recently, which he suggests that if you have a strong ferromagnetic layer, which is what I would call this ruthenium layer, and a superconducting state, of course, has to not be destroyed by the proximity to that layer, and if the interface is smooth, it helps, that those promote a pi phase.
Well, it was done by Boudin many years ago. It was also studied experimentally, keeping in mind this theory.
Yeah.
And in Leiden, in particular, I know there was.
Okay, summarize. How coexistence is possible? Here are some of the features that I've been talking about. Volume average magnetization is not so large. It's a good ferromagnet, but it's not huge. The superconducting and ferromagnetic subsystems are disjoint. So we're not talking about the kind of thing really that Ginsburg was talking about, whereas homogeneous magnetization, the superconductivity, not disjoint. Different electrons, different regions of space.
Not simply different electrons, but especially
different regions of space.
Yeah.
Okay. So these subsystems are precisely layered, thinly layered. The exchange coupling from the ferromagnetic to the superconductor is weak and apparently allows superconductivity to remain. Okay, somehow, this is just a comment, the ferromagnetism, actually there is one unpublished question I've heard about the ferromagnetism, whether it's really long-range ferromagnetic order. Because if it is, you're supposed to be able to see that as an increase in the Bragg peaks when you go through the transition. that's something that there's been a little work done with neutrons, and they haven't detected that yet. Anyway, that's what?
It wasn't detected by neutrons.
It was not.
It was not.
But if you deny that neutrons, the gadolinium is the sort of best neutron absorber in the periodic table, and if you've got. What has been done with neutrons? Is it on this hemisphere or hoping for some absorber as well, of course?
So with neutrons, I'm not sure what else has been done. Jeff Lynn has been involved with that at NIST.
And with powders, it's very difficult to pick up one electron, magnetic scattering scales of the moment square, but it's not like looking for manganese 2 prime or something like that.
So just the one thing I want to emphasize, I think one thing that's important to superconductivity in this kind of system is to have a Fermi surface where the exchange splitting is very small. And the other Fermi surfaces, the exchange splitting is not nearly as small on this particular symmetric barrel Fermi surface here. So at that point, I will come back to any questions that we set aside earlier.
I can't remember well, the details of the Rama-Wertheim theory on combined superconductor paramagnetic, but wasn't that basically similar? You had incomplete arrangements,
but that was all where Tm, as I've called it, and Ts are comparable. So both order parameters are small. You do a Landau-Ginzburg theory and study all that, but it's in a completely different regime.
On the analytical side, you mentioned several consequences of what could happen with superconductivity in such a layered material. So it may be homogeneous, maybe like on the barrel, maybe the pi layer. Are there any considerations what would happen in terminating? Yes, yeah, in this situation, it's also some homogeneous magnetic state, or
well, if the two transition temperatures, two ordering temperatures are comparable, then that's what you find, that both order parameters work to accommodate the other somehow. And there are different things. You have spiral ferromagnetism. Right.
But this only happens if TT is comparable with or even less.
Right.
It's much higher than probably
right.
I would like to make a brief comment about some work that Vladimir Anisimov and myself were thinking about this, the context of it. Can I make some statements on the blackboard?